This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guests are Tom Hanks, the star of the new movie Captain Phillips, and Paul Greengrass, the film's director. It's based on the memoir by Captain Richard Phillips about an incident 4 years ago when Phillips was the captain of an American-flagged container ship that was boarded by Somali pirates. They captured Captain Phillips and held him hostage on a small lifeboat, leading to a lengthy drama at sea. Much of it was covered on television as a U.S. Navy destroyer tailed the lifeboat and Navy SEAL sharpshooters eventually freed the captain. Director Paul Greengrass began his career as a journalist making documentaries, often in war zones. Among his films are The Bourne Supremacy, The Bourne Ultimatum, Bloody Sunday, and United 93. Tom Hanks is a two-time Academy Award winner, getting back-to-back Oscars for Philadelphia and Forrest Gump. Tom Hanks and Paul Greengrass spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. They began with a clip from Captain Phillips, in which the pirates have boarded the ship and are shooting their way through security gates, trying to reach Captain Phillips, played by Hanks, who's on the ship's bridge. The captain speaks to his crew through a handheld radio.
Four pirates on board, four pirates coming towards us down the main deck.
Lock down the bridge.
Yeah.
Listen up. We have been boarded by four armed pirates. You know the drill.
We stay hidden no matter what. I don't want any hostages.
We stay locked down until help arrives. No one comes out until you hear the non-duress password from me, which is supper time.
Jesus.
If the pirates find you, remember, you know the ship. They don't. Make them feel like they're in charge, but keep them away from the important things like the generator and the engine controls. Stick together, and we'll be all right. Good luck.
Well, Tom Hanks, Paul Greengrass, welcome to Fresh Air. Tom Hanks, what appealed to you about this role?
The details of everything that happened. The story itself was written very large. It was covered in the media. You could say it was like ripped right out of today's headlines. But all of the little intricacies of how a ship like that is run and the details of the nature of the Somalis and the particulars of everything that happened in those crucial hours on board the ship and in the days in the lifeboat was loaded with human behavior that I thought was fascinating, compelling, and unknown. There's a style of making this movie. There's a way of making this movie in which it pays most attention, I think, to sort of like the crackerjack action aspect of it. And that was always going to be a part of it in my head. But the particulars of how a guy like Richard Phillips starts working out this algorithm in his head the moment he first sees the pirate skip approaching, that was brand new territory.
Now Paul Greengrass, you know, there are filmmaking techniques, high-tech filmmaking techniques, including computer-generated graphics that will allow you to, you know, create a ship being chased by pirates or broken in half by a hurricane without anybody having to get wet or seasick. You chose a different route. Why?
Well, I mean, several reasons, really. I really wanted the experience of shooting on the ocean. Partly that was personal. My father was in the Merchant Marine and was at sea all his life. So I sort of wanted to explore his world, really. But also from the film point of view, I felt it would be a more authentic film if we all shot it together on the ocean and we had the real ships. And that was, as it proved, you know, I think it meant that everybody, you know, for instance, was on the sister ship of the Maersk Alabama. It was an identical ship. It had a crew. It meant we could draw information from the crew and draw information and veracity from the actual environment. And I think it made it an endlessly fascinating experience, but a richly kind of created one from a filmmaking point of view.
So you had a real container ship, like the one that was in the actual incident. Tom Hanks, you want to talk about what shooting in a ship on the ocean, how that was different than it might have been on a soundstage? What it added to your performance?
It's actually a wonderful thing to have in your pocket. You're in the environment. You're not having to recreate the environment. So much of working on a soundstage is utilizing your imagination and the arts and crafts of the people who build sets and design them. Well, here we were on a real bridge, and all the controls actually did operate the ship. There were some things we were not allowed to touch, and we shouldn't push that button. But as Paul said, we had a constant source of information about filling up the procedures and the behavior of what it takes in every circumstance that we were on the boat, on the ship. So to be an actor and actually walking up and down those many, many stairways up and down to the bridge, it just made it an environmental experience as opposed to just a pretend one.
Did you pick anything up from the crew?
Oh, oceans of that's all. How about I use that?
Is there
oceans of information, David?
Right, a bottomless source of detail. Can you think of a detail that you picked up from the crew that you think kind of just helped with the authenticity of it?
For the captain, there is a never-ending series of pressures that are, some of it is paperwork, some of it is human behavior, much of it is physics, a lot of it is science and weather, that never go away. For example, both Richard Phillips and the captain of the actual Maersk Alexander we were on says he begins and ends his day with a walk around of the entire ship, and that means the entire ship, every square inch of it down below. And he's just looking, they're just looking to see of what might happen, and you'd be amazed at how often a bolt is not in place or something is not lashed down correctly. And when that happens, the next thing you know, you can lose half of your deckboard cargo. The attention to detail and I think the professionalism of all the people that I saw was fascinating. There's one night that we were moving from one port to the other, and Michael Chernis and I, Michael plays Shane, the first mate, he and I were on board for what we thought initially would be about a 40-minute little sail, but instead it turned into all night long. Because you have to get out of port, then you have to go out to pass the bunker station, and then you have to wait for your place in line, and the pilot has to come out on the pilot boat, and 14 ships are ahead of you. And just there's a continuous shift of the watches on board. You think these guys are just standing there doing nothing, but in fact, they're keeping their eye on an awful lot of the gauges as well as the horizon to see where all the other ships are. So you just find out just how intricate it is, and it's always more fascinating than your general knowledge has already provided you.
Paul Greengrass, I read somewhere that it's sort of a saying among directors that one mistake you don't make is try and shoot on the water.
Everybody said that to me before I started this movie.
So what were some of the challenges that this presented?
Well, you've got just the practicalities. Filmmaking is about resources. You know, you need to be able to supply your units, your camera units, your sound units. You need, you know, to be able to get all your costumes and makeup and all the, you know, the infrastructure of it, you know, charger, walkie-talkies, everything. Obviously, if you're on a ship, even a large container ship, incidentally, we were very restricted, you know, by law, with the number of people we could put on the ship. It's not like saying, can you just get, you know, Joe to run a couple of walkie-talkies up to the stage? Well, you know, if you're 20 miles out to sea, that's quite a prodigious operation, and you've got to climb up 30, 40 feet of ladder. So just the sheer logistics are difficult. Then you've got the weather, which is a profound issue. I mean, a lot of the shooting of this involved very small craft, particularly those skiffs. And what I wanted to make the film play was water that was dangerous enough to make it, you know, so you understood, you know, the drama of a skiff attack on a fast-moving container ship. But obviously that, you know, involves very large safety issues. So we needed sea that was aggressive enough to be dynamic, but not so aggressive that it was dangerous or too dangerous. And so that was a constantly, you know, shifting. I mean, I began to get that sort of seaman's affliction of constantly looking at the weather, constantly looking at the sky, trying to guess how the sea was going to go.
Well, Tom Hanks, I wanted to talk to you about getting this character, and I know that you had conversations with the real Captain Richard Phillips, as did we at Fresh Air. I interviewed him when his memoir came out in 2010, and I thought we would listen to just a little bit of that. This is a moment near the end of the interview where he's been through this shattering experience, and I asked him how it affected him emotionally then.
I did have problems. First two nights, I would find myself waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning and just be crying my eyes out, bawling. Something a New England sea captain doesn't do too much. It was sort of strange to me. So I would, throw some water in my face, and I was just going, what are you, a wimp? I'm alive. What are you going to be complaining about? I was able to talk to, actually one of the SEALs insisted I talk to a psychologist, and I did, and he really broke it down into chemicals that are excreted by your various glands and what happens, and he would ask me questions about things I had. And the only problem I had was I would wake up at that time. It happened twice to me the first two nights I was off the life raft. After talking to him after the second morning, he asked me, what did I do? And I said, well, I told just what I said. I'd throw water in my face. I'd go take a shower. I'd say, what are you, a wimp? What's your problem? And he said, well, don't do that. Don't fight it. Let it flow. Let it flow as long as it goes. And so I followed his advice, and I let it flow. I just sat there in my bed, and I probably cried and bawled like a little kid for, 2 minutes. And then it ran its course. I dried up. And I threw water in my face. I took a shower and started my day with my coffee. And I never had a problem after that.
And that is the real. That is the real.
That's
captain.
So rich. That's so rich, Phillips.
Yes, just for our audience, we just heard Captain Richard Phillips. He is the real Merchant Marine captain who was kidnapped by Somali pirates in 2009. His story is the basis of the film Captain Phillips, and we're speaking with Tom Hanks, who stars in the film as Captain Phillips, and Paul Greengrass, its director. So, Tom Hanks, tell us about this guy and how you got a fix on him.
Well, he is actually a very happy-go-lucky, funny, goofy guy. That recollection of the clip is almost like he has a humorous pragmatism about everything that he's been through and that he went through. You find out, like, for example, from Andrea's wife, there was a time that she would go visit him when he was working, and she stopped doing it long ago because as soon as he steps on board the ship as the captain, he becomes just the opposite. He is no nonsense. He is a stickler for detail. He is a pain in the neck to almost everybody that he comes in contact with, and that's the pressures of the command. You know, you can always ask him questions about, were you scared? Were you afraid? Do you think you're going to lose your life? And he had told me that there were two occasions previously as a merchant mariner that he thought for sure that he was going to die at sea. Once was during a hurricane, which was a fear that lasted for the better part of 6 hours. And another was a fire on board one of his ships, and that went on for hours as well. So it went on a little bit longer, the 5 or 6 days that it was being held that way. But the lesson that he told me that he learned from it all was that you can withstand more than you think you can withstand. And it's evident even in the fact that he was able to be cognizant about the chemical reactions that was happening to him and the physiological breakdown that he had well after he knew that he was safe.
Now, Tom Hanks, one of the remarkable moments in the film, and it's a remarkable moment in the story, is when the pirates first make it to the bridge and confront Captain Phillips. I mean, mm-hmm. The captain has seen them coming on radar and then tried to repel them. And finally, face to face, there are these people that he's feared. Paul Greengrass, there's an interesting story about the way you chose to kind of capture the drama of that moment in this scene. Tell us about that.
I think pretty much most directors would do what I did. You're talking about fashioning a confrontation between four young men who've not acted professionally before and Tom, who's a two-time Academy Award winner. I didn't want them to be intimidated on the one hand from the job in hand, but on the other hand, I didn't want them to have become friends, because in the end, the job was to come through that door and terrorize and threaten and be believable. So we kept them apart. And it's the sort of trick you play, I'm afraid, when you're a director. You're trying to create moments that everybody's looking forward to in a shoot. If there's something that's 2-3 weeks down the road where everybody's going, that's going to be an exciting day when those two groups meet each other. And I think it got everybody excited, and you could feel the set was, there was a good tension in the air. But of course, if you're making the film, there's that bit in your mind that's like a sports coach. You can prepare people as much as you like, but in the end, when they cross that white line, it's about how much desire they've got. And of course, from Tom's point of view, he'll tell you himself, what you want as an actor is somebody stepping forward and coming at you, because then you've got something to play against, and that's called drama, you know.
Okay. Let's hear about it. Tom Hanks, I mean, you didn't talk to these Somali guys at all in the shooting until that scene when they confronted you on the bridge. Is that right?
We didn't. We figured out, us on the crew, says, we're not going to meet these guys, are we? Oh, no, we're not. There's not going to be a party at the hotel that kicked, hey, let's celebrate the beginning of principal photography, and we'd have cocktails with them. We knew that that was the day. We had seen there as little dots on the horizon because they'd be working on the skiffs, you know, far away. You can maybe make a little bit out of them through binoculars. But no, we heard them coming. We had the views of them from we were up on the bridge, and here they came. And I think there's three of us, actually, that are in the scene on the bridge. And it was tense. We were scared in the, well, kind of like the best way possible, because we know the guns aren't loaded, but those guys were. They came in, you know, pumped up of all the anxiety of being there in the first place and all the expertise that they had learned, all the work that they had done. So when they came in, I have to say that when they first blew that door open and came in screaming at us, I saw four of the skinniest, scariest human beings on the planet. And the hair did stand up on the back of our heads, and it was chaotic. It seemed like the rules had gone right out the window. In one way, we're just trying to survive the scene, which translates to surviving the moment in the film. And what is amazing is that having seen the film, realizing that what it takes up about maybe 12 or 13 minutes of screen time from the moment when they first get on to when Musi and Phillips go off to start searching the ship, that was a full, harried day of 10 hours of shooting. Now, without a doubt, after the fourth or fifth take, when we start moving on, you know, to shoot another aspect of the scene, you do say, hey, how you doing? Nice to meet you. So you have those kind of moments. So they say something like, oh, I've been watching a movie all my life. You know, you do have those moments, but you do then get right back to it. And they were so on fire that when I saw the movie and could read the subtitles, it was fascinating to hear what they were saying, because we had no idea, you know, shouted Somali sounds like it doesn't sound like a language you can possibly recognize. And for all the reasons that you would do it that way, it achieved its desired effect. We were petrified.
Wow. So they knew their lines and you knew your lines, but you didn't even know what their lines meant. So you were just playing it out.
I had one kind of like piece of information in my pocket, which is that Rich had this fabulous lie and truth that he kept telling them at the same time. I don't know. I'm here with you. You know, they would ask questions, where's your crew? I don't know. He did know where they were, but that was a lie. But he would also say, because I'm here with you. What's wrong with your ship? I don't know. I'm here with you. What's happening? I don't know. I'm here with you. That got played again and again and again, because, look, the lines went right out the window. The pacing went right out the window. There was no rhyme or reason to it. And I have to say, these guys were so good, the two Barkads and Mahat and Faisal, that moments came out that did not exist even in the imagination of everybody involved in the movie. It was particularly when Musi, Berkat Abdi, says, hey, I'm the captain now. That wasn't in the screenplay. That just came out because we were riding the ups and downs of the scene that suddenly had no rules.
Wow. Paul Greengrass, you want to talk a little bit about working with the Navy? You know, you shot the container ship scenes near Malta. The Navy said, well, we want to help. We can get you a destroyer. I think one of the most powerful moments in the film is after Captain Phillips is rescued, he is brought aboard the USS Bainbridge, the destroyer, and he's taken to the sick bay and greeted by personnel there. Tell us a little bit about that scene, Paul.
Well, we had a day, I think it was getting close to the end of the shoot, and the scene that we were due to shoot was actually a scene from Richard's book, which was a bit later on, actually, where he'd been cleaned up and he'd been given a uniform and he was shown up to the captain's quarters and given a beer and TV and a phone to call home. That was really the scene. And Tom and I shot that most of the day, but sometimes when you're filming, you can shoot a scene and it's fine and it's going well, but you just know deep inside both of you without even looking, you just know that there's something better. But where is it? Where is that elusive thing that you're looking for, that moment of truthfulness that's going to encapsulate the experience that this man has gone through. And we happen to have Captain Frank Castellano from the actual Bainbridge on board, I think it was, who said that he'd first seen Rich Phillips down in the infirmary. So we raced down there at the end of the day. There wasn't much time, which in a way was good because I think it meant that none of us had time to think. You know, sometimes you can get your best moments in a film in a place of absolute blind panic because nobody's got time to censor themselves. So you get just sheer naked instinct. And we went down there and we went up to the young medical team, the young corpsman there, and I said, listen, just treat this as a training exercise, just accept it's got Tom Hanks in it. She looked at me as if I was demented.
This was first, a woman, first
class,
right?
Yeah, first class industrial film we were shooting there. Right there.
And I'll let Tom take over the story now.
Well, yeah, those people did not know they were going to be in a movie that day.
But these are actual Navy personnel, and just to reset the story, I mean, you're coming out of this, you've been through a shattering experience. I mean, you've been physically bruised, you've been sleep deprived, you're a wreck, and you come down and there are these folks that are going to take care of you. They're actual Navy personnel who have no idea they're going to be in a movie.
No, none. And Paul just said, well, what would you do? And she just ran through, well, I'd, you know, try to get his focus. I'd try to talk to him. I'd try to find out how badly he's wounded. I'd try to figure out what blood is his. I'd try to figure out if there's any internal bleeding. I'd take his vital stats. She had a whole procedure, you know, equal to an emergency medical technician. And so we we cranked it, let fly. It fell apart. The very first take fell apart for technical reasons and also because it was loaded with moments of great self-consciousness, even from the Navy folks. And so they said, sorry, sorry, sorry. And we said, look, do not apologize. There's no such thing as sorry. This happens all the time. We stop scenes. Don't feel like you've committed anything wrong. We'll just get up and do it again and just follow through. And there's nothing you can say that is incorrect. And there's nothing you can do that is not going to be worthwhile. So just go ahead and do it. And we did five or six versions of it I don't remember much of it, a dizzying period of time. And what I was working from was actual photographs and a little bit of home video of Phillips, the actual Phillips on board the Bainbridge, when people are congratulating him, saying welcome home. And he's in an absolute daze. You can see in his body language and in his eyes, he's barely cognizant of the surreal realities that has just happened to him. And on top of that, it was a very nice lady and a very crack team being sweet to Rich Phillips. So it ended up being quite evocative.
Yeah, no, it's just an amazing moment. I mean, kind of seeing her doing her job in a courteous way and bringing this guy back.
She says something that is just heart-rendering, which is that you're okay. You're going to be okay. And those are the greatest words that a human being could hear in that circumstance.
Tom Hanks, Paul Greengrass, congratulations on this film. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom Hanks and Paul Greengrass spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies last Monday. Hanks stars in the new movie Captain Phillips. Greengrass directed it. There are lots of books about Ben Franklin, but now there's a new book about his sister Jane called Book of Ages. It's by New Yorker staff writer and Harvard historian Jill Lepore. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan says it's filled with revelations.
Her days were days of flesh. That's just one of a multitude of striking observations that Jill Lepore makes about Jane Franklin, the baby sister of Ben. What Lepore means by that line of near poetry is that Jane Franklin's life, beginning at age 17 when she gave birth to the first of her 12 children, was one of nursing, lugging pails of night soil, butchering chickens, cooking, and scrubbing. "I am in the middle of a great wash," she once wrote in a letter. The crumbly green and white soap Jane would have used for that great wash was from an old Franklin family recipe. When Ben was serving as America's diplomat to France, he liked to present his aristocratic hosts with cakes of that homemade soap that his sister Jane sent him from her tiny house in Boston. Canny Ben felt that emphasizing his humble origins would trick his French counterparts into underestimating him. Jane Franklin never had to strategize to be underestimated. After all, she was an 18th century woman. And yet she had a skill that set her apart. She could write. Lepore says that though girls in Massachusetts at the time were routinely taught to read, only gentlemen's daughters could do more than scrawl their names, if that. It was Big Brother Ben who taught Jane to write and thus enabled their lifelong animated correspondence. Ben also stoked Jane's thirst for intellectual and political reading material. Benny and Jenny, as they were called as children, were each other's companions of the heart, though, as Lepore puns, one ascended to the ranks of great men, while the other remained behind with the little women. Book of Ages is the name of Lepore's extraordinary new book about Jane Franklin. But to call it simply a biography would be like calling Ben's experiments with electricity mere kite flying. Lepore says that in addition to telling Jane's story, she's also meditating here on the limits of traditional genres like biography and history, which by necessity still favor the lives of public figures. Jane Franklin's life was mostly lived in the shadows, so to read its traces, Lepore augments her own training as a historian with literary criticism, archaeology, sociology, and even some of the techniques of fiction. The end product is thrilling, an example of how a gifted scholar and writer can lift the obscure out of silence. In so doing, Lepore enriches our sense of everyday life and relationships and conversational styles in colonial America. Finally, a happy side effect of this book about Jane is that it offers a fresh look at Ben Franklin and his writings, particularly those like the Silence Do Good essays in which he posed as a woman, a pose that may have been prompted by his empathetic relationship with Jane. In contrast to her brother's voluminous output, Jane Franklin wrote but one book. It's called Book of Ages, hence Lepore's title, and it consists of 16 little pages of hand-stitched paper on which Jane recorded the births and deaths of her children. Lepore calls it a litany of grief. For Jane's lighter voice, much more playful than her brother's, Lepore turns to her surviving letters. In them, Jane confesses to a taste for gossip, or as it was called, trumpery, and agrees with Ben that their family suffers from a miffy temper. It's something of a minor miracle that she had time to write any letters at all. Jane's ne'er-do-well husband, Edward Meekham, was chronically broke. And so to generate some income, she eventually turned their overcrowded four-room home into a boarding house. By the time the Revolutionary War erupted in Boston, Jane was a 63-year-old widow. She fled before the ransacking British Army, carrying her Book of Ages and her brother Ben's letters in a trunk. While Franklin devoted his intellectual and diplomatic skills to the revolutionary cause, Jane spent years wandering, staying with friends and scattered family. "I am grown such a vagrant," she wrote. Lepore says that if Franklin, in his poses and writing, meant to be every man, Jane is everyone else. The brilliance of Lepore's book is that plain Jane's story becomes every bit as gripping and in its own way important as Big Ben's public triumphs.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Book of Ages by Jill Lepore. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Daniel Radcliffe talks about Harry Potter and child stardom and surviving it. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Daniel Radcliffe, grew up on screen during the course of his 8 Harry Potter films. Many child stars find themselves washed up by the time they reach adulthood, but Radcliffe's career is going strong, and he's taken on roles you may not have predicted from a boy wizard. Radcliffe starred in a London and New York production of Equus, in which he appeared nude. He sang and danced in the leading role of a Broadway revival of the musical How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. He co-stars with John Hamm in a new series produced for British television that's just premiered here on the Ovation Network called A Young Doctor's Notebook. And in the new movie Kill Your Darlings, Radcliffe stars as poet Allen Ginsberg, who became an important figure in beat culture, the 60s counterculture, and gay culture. Kill Your Darlings is set in 1944 when Ginsberg was a freshman at Columbia University. Terry spoke with Daniel Radcliffe last Thursday.
Daniel Radcliffe, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with how you got cast in the part of Allen Ginsberg in Kill Your Darlings. What made the director think of you?
From what he's told me, he saw something in Allen's situation in life, which was that of somebody trying to figure out who they are creatively. And he saw, I think, a parallel of that in my life as somebody who had, come out of one thing, obviously Potter, which I'm very known for, and trying to establish it, yeah, and the small indie films I did, and trying to establish myself outside of that. And I think he saw some parallels in just the also, I think most people in any kind of creative industry have an operating system that runs between the extremes of self-doubt and anxiety and ambition. That's definitely something that Allen has, and I think that's something that I probably have in common with him.
When I heard that you were cast to play Ginsberg, part of me was thinking, well, Ginsberg looks so Jewish, and certain like Hebraic intonations was such a part of his style of reading and sometimes the style of writing, like Kaddish, and I was thinking, I don't know, Daniel Radcliffe, does he look Jewish? I don't know. And then I'm like reading your biography and like your mother's Jewish.
Yeah.
Not that you need to be Jewish to take the part. I'm just telling you what I was,
No, I know.
Appropriately or inappropriately thinking.
No, you know what? It's funny because I think there is some weird thing. Like when I just played an Irish character in The Cripple of Inishmahan over the summer, and the director of that show, Michael Grandage, was saying to everyone, you know, Dan's dad's Irish and all this, and then the director of this movie, John, is saying to everyone, you know, Dan is Jewish, he is. So like both my son, so I don't know if like there's a role or something, but I mean, I'm very proud of my Irish and Jewish roots, but I certainly wouldn't say that my Judaism had in any way had been a part of my life in nearly the same way it was Allen's. But yeah, it's interesting that people like feel the need to sell me as like he is Jewish, he can't play a Jew, like it's okay, you guys, you don't need to worry, like he has his, like the entire Jewish community is just gonna freak out if a non-Jewish person plays a Jew.
Well, no, but really. You should see what the wizards were saying when you took the role of Harry Potter. It's like, well, he's not really a wizard, you cannot give him the role. You're okay?
Yeah, sorry. I should really have used that cough button that's lit up in front of me.
All right. Oh, too late now.
It is. Sorry about that. I didn't. Yeah.
So Ginsberg was also gay, which you're not, but you've given a lot of money to gay rights groups. And I've read that you've said that that's because you grew up with so many gay men when you were exposed to homophobia for the first time, like you were shocked because it was so not part of the world that you were in, which I imagine was like the acting world.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. My mum was a casting director and my dad was a literary agent. So, like, and they had both been actors when they were younger. So I grew up knowing loads of gay men, and it was just not, it was, you know, it's not even something you question. You just go, like, you know, you don't think about it. And yeah, and somebody was asking me about this earlier, just was saying, like, why is it that you give so much attention to, you know, the Trevor Project and things?
It's an anti-gay bullying project. Yeah.
Yes, sorry. Thank you. It actually started from like an interview I was doing when I was 17, 18 in London, and I was being interviewed by Attitude, which is a gay magazine in England, in the UK, and they were telling me lots about lots of gay rights issues that had come up recently in the UK, and then they were asking me about stuff, and as I started talking, I became aware of how passionate I was getting and how opinionated, and I suddenly was like, I've never really spoken this strongly on any like political issue before. Like, I don't mean to sound like a horrible person, but I've never had the same, you know, zeal for the environment that I know a lot of people do. Like, I'm not that I don't care, but it's like, it's just that you find what you're passionate about. And with this thing, I suddenly started talking about it. And I think it is a consequence of the fact that when I went to school and suddenly was seeing people be homophobic, and even though I was, you know, 9 or 10, and there was, you know, nobody in my class, well, certainly nobody in my class had come out at that point, you know, and but it was just like homophobic words and slang being thrown around as insults.
So you say you were exposed to like homophobia and homophobic slurs when you were in school. When
were you in school?
I know there was a period when you were doing Harry Potter films when you were basically being tutored outside of school so you could make the movies.
No, absolutely. I mean, I pretty much left full-time formal education when I was 11.
Did you go back to school afterwards?
I would go back for, I think the longest stretch I went back for was a term and a half when I was about 14. A semester and a half. And then other than that, I would just really go back for exams. And it wasn't something I looked forward to. I was, you know, so happy on set and I loved it there that I really didn't love going back to school. And also, even my education on set, like, I was not very academic as a child when I was at school. I was really not bottom of the class, but not far off it either, and found concentrating very hard and all of that stuff that you always hear. And, you know, being tutored one-to-one on set was just fantastic. And also, you know, I'm a very hyperactive person, so if you tell me to sit still and shut up and learn and just take in information, it's not going to happen.
So I want to ask you a question that you've probably been asked a lot. You've probably been asked everything a lot, but so you know, in the new movie Kill Your Darlings, you're playing Allen Ginsberg when he's 17, and he's just kind of exploring his own sexuality. And did people ever resist you being sexualized at all, straight or gay, on screen because they first knew you when you were 11 in the first Harry Potter film, and they couldn't really maybe accept you growing up?
Maybe, but I think I shocked them out of that with Equus. I mean, like, it's
right, because you were nude on stage in that.
Yeah, Equus was and it's a very complicated sexual character. Alan in Equus, he's somebody who has at some point he's a seriously disturbed kid who has got his religion and sexuality mixed up with the idea of worshipping horses. You know, so if anybody had any kind of qualms about seeing me in a slightly challenging or older or sexualized role, I mean, they probably didn't come and see it, is the truth. But that's, you know, that's fine. It doesn't seem to be, it certainly hasn't been an issue in terms of casting or in terms of any of the scenes I've been doing in the last year, and hopefully it won't be a problem for people going forward, because I don't want to be creeping people out all the time.
So your mother is a casting director. When you first started working in movies, and particularly in the Harry Potter films, did your mother have a hand in that? Was she trying
to... No, not at all.
Like, persuade or... persuade you into or out of doing acting?
Yeah, she was trying to persuade me out of it, I think. Both my mum and my dad had not had great experiences as actors, and when I was initially asked to audition for Harry, they both said no, because at that time the deal was that we'd have to sign on for 7 films and that they'd all be made in America, and they just said no, that would be too big a shift to his life, that's not going to happen. And so months later, when the deal had changed and we were only having to sign on for 2 and they would both be filmed in the UK, and I think coupled with the fact that I was really like not having a great time at school, I think she just thought, well, they thought, okay, well, you know, maybe this is where we should let him audition, and then everything sort of went from there.
Had you read Harry Potter books before auditioning for the part?
I'd read the first 2, but that was it. I wasn't nearly the sort of fanatic that a lot of other people who were auditioning were, and which is why I think there's quite a few people that were pissed off when I got the part, and I said in my first press conference, because I was 10 or 11 or whatever, and I was just like, oh, you know, I've only read the first 2, and you know, and of course there was some, you know, person writing in the newspaper the other day going, how dare they not pick a true fan for the thing, and you just go, oh, Jesus.
So you'd never studied acting, but you got this incredible on-set education. Did each of the actors and the directors kind of share with you the type of training that they got? Were you exposed to everybody's training?
Not really, no. I mean, there's, you know, the directors, you don't have time, like, on a film set to, like, train a kid up at the same time as doing your own job. You know, there's no... it's just about... It was, I think, the onus was on us to watch and learn. You know, Alan Rickman's not suddenly going to, you know, take time out of his day to talk to you about something, you know, when you've got a shot to get or whatever. I mean, Alan has actually, incidentally, been an incredibly supportive person in my life and has come to see me in every theatre endeavour I've ever done and you know, has been amazing. And actually, since Potter has... taught me huge amounts, but I think it's not always, you know, you're on a film set, everyone's there to do a job, so it's not always, you know, the first thing on everyone's mind would be to, like, oh, let's, you know, give these kids a theatrical education while we're here. But I definitely think that, you know, you learn a lot just by watching those guys and by taking it in. And the most important thing I really think I learned during Potter from a lot of those actors was just how to be on set and who I admired for how they handled themselves on set, because there are some people that handle themselves so brilliantly that they make everybody's day better by the way they conduct themselves. Like Imelda Staunton is one of them, who plays Dolores Umbridge in the fifth film. You know, and Gary Oldman, David Thewlis, they're all guys that can lift a set because of what they bring to it. And I think watching that really made an impression at a young age and gave you a sense of the responsibility you have if you're a lead actor on a film. Because if you come onto set with a terrible attitude, then everyone else immediately sees that, and then if you don't want to be there, why should they want to be there? And, you know, I think if you walk on with a good attitude, enthusiastic and happy to be doing what you're doing, then, you know, hopefully that helps engender a better atmosphere. And I don't think I don't think all actors realize the power they have in that.
So you were a child actor with a lot of young fans and older fans as well. But, you know, I think film fans in general, but I think, you know, children who are fans in particular have trouble differentiating between the actor and the character.
Yeah,
so
younger fans, absolutely.
When you were young and in the early Harry Potter films, and a lot of your child fans were confusing you with the character, was that confusing for you, since you were so young yourself and so new to all of this? Like, you just stepped into stardom at such a young age.
I think I just found it funny. I mean, I didn't ever really get, like, panicked or confused by it. I think I just always found it kind of funny that I would provoke reactions from people. I think also when you start very young, you've more of a chance to, like, adapt. I always think it's much harder if I'd got famous, like, in my late teens or early 20s, to then have to deal with all that. I think is a lot harder than if you kind of just grow up with it and you sort of adapt to it a lot better if you grow up with it.
What was the hardest part for you of proving that you could be things other than Harry Potter as an actor?
You know, ultimately, the person I'm proving that to most is myself. And ultimately, the stuff that is hardest about that is just moments of self-doubt and moments of worry. But you can't let that worry or that self-doubt really take any kind of hold. I mean, there's no point. I think there was a moment shortly after Potter where I did feel like, you know, what if I never go on to anything? You know, how will I feel? But you consider that question and then consider the answer and then use that as fuel to motivate yourself to not let it happen.
Do you ever ask yourself, do I still really want this? Do I still really want to act? Because I'm asking that because, like, you just grew up in it, and a lot of people like fantasize about what it's going to be, and they work so hard to get it, and they search for themselves, and then they find themselves in their career. But, like, you had it all along.
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean any of it was easy.
Right.
Like, you know, that it's just because, like, I think there does seem to be this idea that, like, if you work on a big franchise, that's an easy version of acting, which, like, it isn't really. Like, it's a different thing, and it's a very different style, but it presents its own very specific set of challenges.
And I didn't mean that the acting was easy.
Not at all.
Once you were in, you didn't have to, like, break in were 22 after college or something, you know?
No, of course. But I think, honestly, the answer is no. There is never a moment's doubt in my mind that this is what I want to do. If I die on a film set when I'm 80, I'll be happy with that. I was, you know, in school when I was young and I hated it. And, you know, the British school system, as I said, if you're not good at certain things, basically makes you feel very, very mediocre and very average. And to suddenly be taken out of that and put into a world where, A, I felt like I belonged, and B, like my insane energy levels that I had, particularly when I was a kid, were not just... Well, they were actually viewed as useful, and people enjoyed that about me, rather than people just trying to tamp it down constantly because it was irritating or, you know, too loud for a classroom. Like, it gave me a purpose and a sense of belonging and a confidence that I doubt I ever would have had I not got into it when I did. And so I want to do it for the rest of my life.
Celebrity can be very damaging, and that might be more true in America than in England, but there are so many people who become famous and then have problems. Or if they become famous when they're young and they don't stay famous, I think there's a lot of like resentments that can build up. So did your parents do anything to protect you from the possibility of all that? Because you're one of the child actors who, like, not only made it out alive, but you've made it out showing your, you know, the range that you're capable of, and you keep doing more and more interesting things. So to what do you attribute your ability to survive the problems of child stardom that so many actors who were child stars fall prey to?
I mean, it's ultimately, a lot of it comes down to my parents. My parents are great people and they've always looked after me. And I don't have, I'm not somebody who has a load of people around him all the time purely there to make him feel better. And that's how I like it. And also, the work has always remained the focus for me. The work's always been the thing I found the most fun. And, you know, there are so many very high profile cases of people who started young and then screwed up. But the truth is that the reason there aren't any high-profile cases of people who were young and then didn't screw up is because people forget that they were ever young. And people sort of just, they just bleed into their adult careers seamlessly, and then everyone sort of forgets. You know, I mean, nobody thinks of Joseph Gordon-Levitt as a child actor who survived. But, like, he is. He was on a huge show when he was a young kid. Jodie Foster, Elijah Wood, Christian Bale all started very, very young. And, you know, I'm hoping that I can join the ranks of the latter rather than the former.
Well, Daniel Radcliffe, I wish we could talk more. You have a very busy schedule. Thank you for spending some of your time with us. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you again. Thank you for having me on. Cheers.
Daniel Radcliffe spoke with Terry Gross last Thursday. He plays a young Allen Ginsberg in the new film, Kill Your Darlings. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sherrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our assistant producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.